You're listening to TIP.
Hey everyone, welcome to this Wednesday's release of the Bitcoin Fundamentals Podcast. This episode is brought to you by River, the place that I personally go to securely invest in Bitcoin with confidence and with zero fees. On today's show, I have a very thoughtful guest, Mr. Max Cai. With all the financialization of Bitcoin ETFs happening and what's expected to occur in the coming years, there are many people concerned about the rehypothecation of collateral and the commingling of funds, and in general, the games of fractional reserve antics that plague traditional markets getting ready to happen, all on top of Bitcoin. Well, today's guest is a veteran in managing these risks for many years, and he's somebody that I'd followed very closely because he continues to provide such services of borrowing and lending without ever being impacted by counterparty risk and the nefarious actors of all these previous cycles where many of them had blown up. As you'll see in the interview, there's a reason why he's managed this risk appropriately, and his message to traditional banks and financial institutions is vital to hear right now. So without further delay, here's my chat with Mr. Max Cai.
Celebrating 10 years, you are listening to Bitcoin Fundamentals by the Investors Podcast Network. Now for your host, Preston Pysh.
Hey everyone, welcome to the show. I am here with Max Cai. It has been, when did we record last, Max? Has it been 4 years or 3 years or something like that? It's been a while. Been
3 years and 4 years. Yeah, it's been a while. Actually, right after we launched the first lending product, you know, it's kind of interesting thing. You were the first. You were the first podcast host I talk about it. But here I am launching another one.
I remember how I got introduced or informed about you, and it was Adam Back that told me. And Adam was just, you know, he was tinkering with HODL, and we had, I forget where we had the conversation. It might have actually been just via text. And we were talking about borrowing and lending and over collateralization and the idea of like, how can somebody actually go about this in a responsible kind of way that does not introduce systematic risk or compound risk to different participants? And he told me at the time that he thought the only way that it was possible to do it was in a peer-to-peer direct between two parties as long as they're over-collateralized. He felt like that was the least risky way to do it. And then he told me about HODL. And from there, I was like, I was very interested. I was very curious. And then you and I have gotten to know each other through the years, and just, it's been a lot of fun. But anyway, I don't want to start there with this conversation. And sorry, I'm talking so much. I want to start with something that I found interesting when I was in Madeira. And I had the privilege of being on stage with Michael Saylor, Lynn, and Larry Lepard asking questions. And one of the questions that I asked to Michael was about borrowing and lending, and where I think everybody's looking at these ETFs and they're looking at Wall Street showing up in style to Bitcoin finally after a decade plus. And they're building these ETF products, and then they're about to construct derivatives on top of this. And I'm looking at you as this person who, I think between you and Mauricio, are like the only two people that I know that have gone through a full cycle and have not blown up a platform or an exchange or whatever, because you're actually doing this in what I would describe as a responsible way, because you're doing actual peer-to-peer over collateralized lending. And so the question that I asked Saylor when we were in Madeira was, we've seen Mt. Gox blow up. We've seen FTX blowing up. We've seen all of these borrowing and lending platforms, BlockFi, whatever you name it, blow up. And now Wall Street's showing up, and it looks like they're going to be playing the fractional reserve games, and they're going to be doing all the things that we know are literally incompatible with Bitcoin in the way that Bitcoin functions, because it's just relentless in the way that it presents itself, but nobody can step in and manipulate it. And so I asked him, I said, what would be your advice to Wall Street today, knowing all of this history and this incompatibility with Bitcoin? And his response, to be quite honest with you, Max, surprised me in his response, because he seemed to imply that he didn't think that it was going to be an issue for Wall Street. But what I want to do is play you the clip, because I deeply trust your opinion on this matter. I want to play the clip, and then I want to get your point of view as you hear his response. So here we go. I'm going to play this clip and hopefully share it here correctly with the people that are watching on YouTube. So here goes the clip.
You know, I don't think they'll have any problem lending against Bitcoin, because they've already got the problem with these other examples is they're all wildcat banks. I mean, people are going to nobody in their right mind would put money in a private, opaque, unaudited operation run by two dudes out of their garage offshore without a mailing address, right? Like, and so the problem wasn't borrowing against Bitcoin. The problem was actually dealing with, you know, people running personal banks out of their basement, and they didn't know how to run a bank. The way all these wirehouses work right now is you have a portfolio of assets, they mark them to market every day, and they give you loans, margin loans with loan to value no more than 50% or something, and actually they will adjust the advance ratio. And the way they manage risk is they just mark them to market. They already know how to mark to market. With Bitcoin, they'll just be able to mark to market 24/7, 365. And normally the way they work is they would say, well, we'll give you a loan of X. If your portfolio is Apple stock and Microsoft and Bitcoin, they'll give you a loan of up to 20-30% of that. And then if those things trade down, they'll just ask you to post more collateral, pay off the loan. And that's a business that works perfectly fine for the last 40 years. All their systems are wired. And the risk here is, the people that got screwed in the Bitcoin loans, they didn't get screwed because the Bitcoin collateral went bad. They got screwed because the bank stole their money, right? And so here you have JP Morgan, Citigroup, Bank of America, Wells Fargo with $1 trillion balance sheet. They don't normally steal their clients' money as a normal thing, right? They're too big to fail. And so I think that, I mean, anybody wanting a mortgage or wanting a credit card or a home loan, they would normally go to a mega bank anyway. And the problem in the market is those banks haven't custodied Bitcoin. And because they don't custody it, it's not part of the collateral package. And there are a lot of reasons why they haven't or they couldn't. But as soon as they can, I actually think the rest of the credit issues become very straightforward, and you'll find a bank will give you either that margin loan in lieu of Apple or Microsoft stock, or sometimes they'll give you a mortgage and they'll say post some other assets as security against the mortgage, and you end up posting some securities and you get a 30-year mortgage with some securities posted to get it going, and they may just take Bitcoin as that security to top up your mortgage or refinance it.
So if I was going to push back on this, I think like if Caitlin Long was here, she would say there might be a frequency mismatch. So when we're looking at the speed of settlement of Bitcoin and we look at the volatility of Bitcoin and then we look at traditional rails, equity certificates, what's the frequency that they're able to, are they 24/7 that we can clear those? And if we're posting collateral with things that can't match Bitcoin's frequency, does that pose systemic risk for some of these custodians?
I don't think it's supposed to be systemic risk. You're talking about 0.1% of the money. It's, but for example, a big bank would give you a $100 million loan against Apple stock over the weekend if you had $1 billion of Apple stock. If you had $300 million of Apple stock, they give you a $100 million loan over the weekend. Maybe something happens and China declares that Apple can't manufacture iPhones, and in the morning, Apple stock gaps down. Well, the bank took the risk, not you. And the bank's already willing to take 48-hour or 72-hour settlement risk on all these other securities. They would be taking an order of magnitude less risk with Bitcoin. So Bitcoin de-risks the bank, but the point really is the banks are already taking more risk and they're comfortable with it. They've got they've got massive balance sheets. They've got hundreds of billions of dollars of equity capital. So the point really is the only thing that's holding back Bitcoin credit markets is the big bulge bracket banks being able to custody Bitcoin. And at the point that they begin to custody Bitcoin, they will start to extend credit as the natural next step. And there's nothing about the asset class that makes it harder for them. It's a better asset for them to extend credit. It's better than the $100 trillion of equity. It's not worse. So I actually think they will embrace it. And their view would be a lot less risk. It's a lot easier to manage. The reason they're not doing it now is not because there's an issue with Bitcoin. It's just they're not able to custody it. And if they can't custody it, there's no handle on it. That's why you don't see that market taking off.
All right, Max. Okay, there was a lot discussed there, but I'm curious to hear kind of your general take as somebody who's an absolute expert in this particular area. What are your thoughts?
Actually, I like the part of, that Michael remembered this saying, too big to fail, which is no longer true, I think, since 2008 and Lehman Brothers, AAA and all that stuff. I remember that year because I was actually working in asset management at that point. I think that the main problem, and actually Lynn later on the same panel, she mentioned that there are companies that actually allowing you to do it in a proper Bitcoin way. And she mentioned Unchain Capital, which is a multi-signature based, basically lending and borrowing, and which we do with HODL and with Bepify as well. So I think that the main issue that not many still yet understand, that there's a huge gap between borrowers and lenders in that sense that if we say that lenders are traditional finance companies, big institutional companies that are used to take custody of the assets, and we say that they want to start lending out money to Bitcoiners or to companies that own Bitcoin on the balance sheet, that there's a huge problem because Bitcoiners and companies, whether it's a legal entity or a private individual, they saw what happened with BlockFi, Celsius. They saw what happened in 2008. They saw what happened in general with when you give a custody of your assets to someone else. I disagree that these companies like BlockFi and Celsius, they were run from a garage, basically. Maybe there was some bad decision made, bad risk management. But in Bitcoin, I think the main value proposition, one of the main value propositions of Bitcoin as a superior asset, and I think Michael will agree with me and generally what he promotes as well, is that this is something that you own. If you have a key to your Bitcoin, this is your asset. It's independent from everything else out there. You don't need to custody those. You take a hardware wallet, cold storage, you send there your Bitcoin, that's it. That's your asset. So when we're talking about Bitcoin borrowing and lending and mentioning the custody, maybe Wall Street and other traditional companies used to do a collateralized lending in that sense that they take a custody of the assets. But with Bitcoin, and what brings us to the next question, what is Bitcoin in general in terms of lending? In Bitcoin, you can do things different, and it's not necessarily bad, or it's not necessarily something worse for a lender or mm-hmm. for a custodian. Mm-hmm. It's just different, way more efficient, and specifically way more forward-thinking towards your customer, which is the end borrower. Who are you providing the services? So I generally disagree with the custody thing. I think I will always disagree with that, because again, we saw BlockFi, Celsius, multiple companies.
Yeah.
There was like Voyager, which was a good company, with all that stuff, blew up. So it doesn't matter whether you run it from your garage or you have an office on the Wall Street. It's a question of how you build your product in a way that you can appeal both to Bitcoiners and both to traditional finance people.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
So one of the most common questions I get from family and friends is, Preston, where do you buy your Bitcoin from personally? And the answer is really simple. I buy it on river.com. Not only can you easily buy Bitcoin with zero fees on recurring orders, you can have peace of mind knowing Bitcoin on River is held one-to-one in multi-sig cold storage, all while being fully licensed and regulated in the U.S. Plus, their relationship managers are U.S.-based and available by phone for you or your business. Additionally, River has built their own infrastructure from the ground up, which means they don't rely on third parties to function like the other Bitcoin exchanges. River also created a new feature not found anywhere else called River Link. It allows you to send Bitcoin over a text message to easily orange pill your family, pay a friend for dinner, or send a gift. There's absolutely a new standard in Bitcoin and River is setting it. So go to river.com/fundamentals and get up to $100 free when you sign up and buy Bitcoin. That's river.com/fundamentals.
If you're a solopreneur, small business owner, or remote worker, then listen up because you've got to hear about Industrious. As a remote worker myself, I'm telling you that Industrious delivers the best co-working space I have ever been to. Industrious has co-working locations in major cities across the US, UK, Europe, Asia, and Australia, and they provide a ton of benefits to their members. They have secure high-speed internet, daily breakfasts and snacks, courteous on-site staff support, and my favorite part is the social events they host, which make it easy for me to connect with others who want to unplug from their work for a bit. I just recently visited their Kansas City office, and the people there were absolutely amazing, and the staff was incredibly helpful to help me get settled in and perform at my best. We Study Billionaires loves Industrious, and they were able to hook our listeners up with a free week of co-working to check it out, take a tour, and experience all of the amazing perks they have to offer. Visit industriousoffice.com, click join now, and use code WSB to redeem a free week of co-working when you take a tour. That's industriousoffice.com, click join now, and use code WSB to get your first week entirely for free. Today's episode is sponsored by Range Rover Sport. Range Rover Sport leads by example with their dynamic design that rises to the occasion. It's got powerful on-road performance and commanding all-terrain capabilities, coupled with signature Range Rover refinement. The third generation Range Rover Sport is the most desirable, advanced, and dynamically capable one yet, redefining sporting luxury. It's got advanced cabin technologies such as active noise cancellation and cabin air purification, offering next level comfort and refinement. The purposeful cockpit light driving position sets the tone for a focused interior that promotes exhilarating driver engagement. Award-winning Pivi Pro infotainment is at the heart of the experience and provides intuitive control of the vehicle systems. You can enjoy a dynamic drive and total comfort with optional 22-way adjustable, heated, and ventilated electric memory front seats with massage function. Design your Range Rover Sport at LandRoverUSA.com. That's LandRoverUSA.com.
All right, back to the show.
Max, at the core, like if we were going to go way upstream and deeply understand the first principles that presents risk and de-risks or reduces the most amount of risk, it seems like commingled funds for the escrow is where the issues are always manifesting themselves, especially when you're using Bitcoin as collateral. So like I look at BlockFi. This is something that I covered even when interviewing the founder of BlockFi back then. We knew back then that you had everyday retail people that were over-collateralized with their deposits if they were borrowing, and you had institutions that were also putting collateral up, but they weren't over-collateralized. And by commingling these two into the same company is why we had issues, even though there were people that were completely over-collateralized in a 24/7, 7 days a week, all days of the year kind of way that should have had no risk whatsoever if it was just them that was over-collateralized. And so that's how you ran HODL-HODL, which was it's point-to-point with another person. It's over-collateralized. There's no commingling of some institution over here that's presenting additional risk. Is that the big one? Is that the big part that needs to be discussed when Wall Street's entering this space is the commingling of collateral?
I think yes. And also, I think what they used to have, again, the custody of the funds, but they used to rehypothecate the funds, right? And that's the main issue.
Yes. You know?
And what they offer, usually the scheme is like on one side, you get a collateral. Mm-hmm. On the other side, you get something. You match those, and then you can, or on the one side, you get a person who wants to earn yield on top of Bitcoin, and on the other side, you have a person who is like happy to provide certain services to get that yield. So number one issue, of course, mingling all the funds. It's true. You need to be always over-collateralized. You don't mix them. You need to store them in a separate multi-signature account, which we do, multi-signature address. You don't re-replicate the fund, but also what I said in the beginning of our panel, which we did with you in Madeira, mm-hmm. was that I think the yield generation products on top of Bitcoin should actually die, because it's like Bitcoin itself is already yield generation product. It's already asset that actually generates you yield. So here's my strategy if you want to generate yield on top of Bitcoin. You buy Bitcoin, you buy hardware wallet, you send your Bitcoin to the hardware wallet, you forget about it. In 4 years, your yield is generated. So it's that simple.
Yeah.
It's that simple. Yeah. You don't need to do anything. Because every time you think about, okay, I want to earn extra 3%, 4% on top of what I'm earning with my asset, you ask yourself from where yield is coming. If you cannot answer that question, probably you are the yield generational asset with you and your Bitcoin. So I think that was the main reason that people get greedy. Of course, greed is good. Gordon Gekka, right? But it's not good when we talk about Bitcoin, specifically when we talk about yield generation products. You know, greed is good. Hold your Bitcoin, hold your keys. Don't give up on custody. If you have to give up on custody, at least make it collaborative custody. At least hold one key and make sure that if you borrow against your Bitcoin is stored in a multisig. It's not replicated. It's technically impossible to replicate one. And that you as a private individual has a proper risk management in that sense that you don't borrow against all your stack. You always have something. In case of a LTV ratio is falling down, you can always add more to collateral, because that's the best way to avoid liquidation. That's the best way to go forward. And again, I think the main thing is that we need to teach Wall Street, because I think we should do a heavy lifting, you know, not only provide them with the tools, but also talk with them, is that Bitcoin is a unique, it's not digital assets, it's a super collateral. That's the mantra we have in DeFi. And we need to teach them that actually in Bitcoin, collaborative custody is possibility. And every sane Bitcoiner is going to be your customer if you will offer a service that is not replicating his fund and that gives him certain level of control and trust in things that you're building or doing or whatever services that you're providing.
I cannot agree with you more. When I look at Bitcoin, it's just a fractal. It's like, it started off, it demonstrated these properties at a very small level. Then you go through another cycle and it's doing it at an even larger level. And now it's literally at this global scale where we have hundreds of billions of dollars in fiat terms, institutions, financial institutions that are now playing around with this. And I think it's naive for us to look at it and say, oh yeah, well, they're the big boys in the room, and they're the smart PhD people that have been schoolhouse trained in how to manage financial instruments. And it's the rules that applied at the lower fractals aren't going to apply up at this fractal. And I'm just kind of shaking my head and I'm saying, if you're commingling funds, if you're doing something that's not over collateralized, you're just going to get destroyed. Like, this thing is just relentless. It doesn't care if you have the name BlackRock or you're just some trading card exchange from years ago. It just does not care. It's going to be relentless. Nobody's coming to rescue you. And I'm just looking at what's playing out and I'm very guarded and very concerned as to moving forward. It seems like you share the sentiment.
I share the sentiment, but again, I'm more positive on that side that, you know, we can and we will provide tools. I mean, in general, as a community, because again, my thesis in that sense is that every major financial institution, every bank out there, the big one, have at least 100 or even 1,000 of people who own Bitcoin among their customers. Mm-hmm. And at some point, those customers are going to go to that bank and going to say, okay, guys, I don't want to sell my Bitcoin. I have Bitcoin. I don't want to sell my Bitcoin. I want to borrow. But we have a long-term relationship history here, right? And I want to borrow from my bank. Mm-hmm. Can you offer a proper service to me? And they said, if you're lucky, they will probably say, yeah, you can custody your Bitcoin with us. And we'll give you 50% LTV ratio. And in case something, we're going to liquidate you, which is fine. That's how business works. But we can rehypothecate your funds. You know, I read those blueprints, you know, terms of services. There's always a possibility to be rehypothecated in that sense. And most of sane Bitcoiners, I would say, they're not going to agree with that. Mm-hmm. And they're going to go to another bank,
yeah,
who's probably might be able to provide a non-custodial setup, a multi-signature setup for your lending and borrowing. It's actually already happening in certain regions. For example, in Switzerland, you have these banks that work with digital assets. They can custody your funds. They can custody Bitcoin, other crypto assets. And we actually been approached by several customers of these banks who told us, like, guys, I can introduce you with people from that bank. I want to borrow from them because it's like we have a long-term relationship with that bank. I trust them. But as a Bitcoiner, I don't trust any custody apart from my own custody or collaborative custody. Mm-hmm. Can you please provide this service to them? I can still borrow from them and they will be my lender, but the Bitcoin that will be holding collateral will be holding a proper multi-signature setup. And we're now talking with several of these banks. And I think this use case are going to grow. Mm. As the price of Bitcoin will grow, there will be more and more people willing to borrow against that. Mm-hmm. And there will be less and less people willing to sell that because the cost of opportunity is very high.
Yeah.
Now, we already have a core layer of people in Bitcoin community, let's say the existing Bitcoin community, who already understand the long-term value of Bitcoin. You know, low time preference people, you know, generational wealth, all these things that for us, it's not just sound, you know, and just words. And I think as more and more people will get to the Bitcoin, obviously, some of them will go through custodian, through, you know, large institutions. And then again, every cycle we see that people get burned because of the greed, because of trusting. Because one of the core mantras in Bitcoin is not only hold your keys, but also don't trust, verify. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't need to trust. And that could be a problem for people or for institutions that actually they have a long-term experience in custodying funds. And again, I don't see anything bad in custodying certain assets. I see bad when you need to custody Bitcoin because there's a lot of tools that can allow you not to do that. And it won't be less convenient than when you custody the funds. Actually, you're taking an extra risk when you custody customers' Bitcoin, you know? Mm-hmm. I think that multisig and again, collaborative custody is less riskier also for a lender or for potential custodian. So yeah. If you offer that type of service, there's like, it's distributed risk, I would say, if we, you know, we figure it out, a new term, distributed risk. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of, I think, a proper risk management here, even better for a potential custodian.
I think one of the things also to discuss when we're talking about risks on borrowing and lending is really kind of where is the mark, the current spot mark coming from? And is that something that you're looking across multiple exchanges? Is it just one reference rate that's being used? What's the liquidity of that? Like, I think it was just a couple of weeks ago, we saw somebody evidently keystroked in a massive, I think it was a sell order or something. And you saw the spot market on that particular exchange just plummet down to absurd levels. I forget what price it got to in fiat terms, but it was like really low. And I'm looking at this and I'm saying, if I was borrowing and lending and I'm using that mark for adding more collateral or, you know, in that situation, you wouldn't even had the time to add more collateral because it happened so quickly. Walk us through that risk and how you guys think about it from a Debify or HODL standpoint.
We usually have a price oracle, and the price oracle actually, it's a compound price feed from multiple exchanges, the most liquid exchanges out there. So we don't take only one exchange or only one trading venue. We use several of them because, again, we are good at this with our experience with HODL HODL. And now we take that experience and move to DeFi. Mm-hmm. And we understand that these things that you mentioned, you know, somebody pressed the button and, you know, that the price just went nuts, completely nuts for a minute, but it's enough already to trigger the liquidation level. So we avoid that and we construct our own price oracles. We actually explain that in our help guides and terms of services, how we do that. We're actually working on improving that. But usually our approach is that we take the most liquid, the biggest exchanges, and we take multiple of them. And if majority of them shows the different price, then of course it's going to affect the price oracle. Mm-hmm. But usually, even if it's one or even two spikes, then most probably is not affected on your collateral, on your liquidation level and LTV level. So it's like, it's also a certain thing that you need to understand when you're doing Bitcoin borrowing. You need to understand how the price feed works for your collateral. What company or platform that's giving you this opportunity to do your lending and borrowing activities, what tech they're using, what price feed they're using. So there's a different approach actually. But I think that's, again, from our experience doing this for multiple years, I think that's the best approach so far that we have.
When you and I have talked privately, you are a huge proponent of this idea of Bitcoin being a super collateral. For people that might hear that or just kind of hear that terminology, they might say, oh, well, that's kind of an interesting idea. Put some context on that of why Bitcoin is such a revolutionary super collateral versus anything that the world has ever seen before.
I think it's number one, it's because it's highly liquid, like extremely liquid asset. If you're a lender, the best collateral that you can lend against is Bitcoin. Why? Because if there's a liquidation coming and your borrower fails to repay your loan, you can liquidate it 24/7, any time of the year. Basically, you can automate this to a level that you even don't know that something happened on the back end. Highly liquid for a lender, from a lender's standpoint of view, because like, take any other asset out there, like real estate, months or even years before you can actually sell it and mm-hmm. you know, get some money back. Mm-hmm. Stocks, you know, usually during the weekend doesn't work. Working hours, all that stuff. Bitcoin, 24/7, 365 days a year, easily to liquidate, deep market, deep liquidity, no issues at all. Now, second important thing is actually fits both borrower and lender is a collaborative custody opportunity. That's more important for a borrower, but as I said, I think lenders should also look from the point of view of security. You know, when you do collaborative custody, you spread the risk. It's a, as I mentioned, distributed risk in that sense that you do understand that there's a certain amount of keys involved in the scheme. If we're talking about multisig, and that even if you fail with your key management, so you lost it somehow, I don't know, you were compromised, it's not necessary that the collateral will be moved. Mm-hmm. Because usually we're talking about either two out of three, so you need to have at least second key, or it's in DeFi we do three out of four, so we have four keys distributed, and you need to have at least three.
Max, what's the breakdown of the four keys, just so we can understand what's going on?
So one key goes to the lender, who are institution in case of DeFi, and that's one of the main differences between HODL HODL and HODL HODL. Like everyone can become a lender on DeFi, only institutional lenders.
Okay.
So one goes to the lender, one goes to the borrower, one key goes to DeFi, and fourth key is held in authorized key holder possession, which is an independent entity who holds the key. And in case of liquidation or in case of dispute, they can co-sign with us and the winning party, the release transaction in favor of the winning party or the party who needs to get the funds after the liquidation. And adding one extra key is actually was, to some extent, it was a crazy idea because 2 out of 3 is more like an industry standard. But then we thought like, well, we don't want to provide liquidity by ourselves. We just want to be a tech providers. You know, we want to provide a platforms for institutional lenders to meet any type of borrower out there who owns Bitcoin. And in order to avoid that and be just technical tool providers, which we're good at, we need to ensure that there's a liquidity stream on the other side. And how we ensure that, we offer the service to other lenders and liquidity providers. Mm. And that's how we came up with the solution. But the issue is that we know how we manage the keys. And we know, for example, we do audit and due diligence on authorized key holders, the independent entity that I mentioned to you. We know how they manage the keys, but we don't know how lenders and borrowers manage the key. We can provide you with all the necessary tools out there. You know, we can do a hardware wallet integration. We actually have a different security system and model in Debify than in HODL. Right. But it's always, you know, there's different levels of attack and getting the key. You know, there's even physical attack. You never can be sure that the lender and the borrower are storing their key properly. Even if you provide them with the most modern, advanced, sophisticated tools, you know, there's still a human factor and there still could be an issue. So this is why we came up with the idea of 3 out of 4. Again, as I mentioned, highly liquid, collaborative custody. And I think one of the main things is also that it's a global thing. You know, we saw with our existing, with HODL, and we see now with Debify that we have lenders based in different regions who are providing the liquidity to borrowers based in different regions. Mm-hmm. If it's not to be a Bitcoin, then most probably they would never met each other, right? It's a global thing. You as an institution who has liquidity and want to provide liquidity, you can actually open new markets easily with Bitcoin. You don't need to have a real estate agent who will go in a certain market, will access the property, you know, do the valuation, and then you will understand. No. The price feed for Bitcoin is up and running. It's there. It's online. You can check on this every second, basically. It's very transparent. And it's also one of the reasons why Bitcoin is a super collateral. It's because it's like the price is highly objective. It's not subjective. It's not something that I value your house for 1 million and you think it's 1.5. Mm-hmm. No, there's a certain price for Bitcoin. You know, its price is there. It's market-driven asset. You cannot say that my Bitcoin here in New York should be traded at the premium plus 5% than your Bitcoin there in Berlin, let's say.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very objective asset. You have a deep market and the market decides what's the price of the asset. And there's like multiple other levels and layers of Bitcoin, why I believe it's super collateral, but I think that we have this unique opportunity in history of, I would say, in human, like in mankind, that we have this highly liquid collateral, which is digital already, which is global, which has a single price, whether you're in Japan, US, or Europe, which can be stored across multiple institutions or across multiple parties involved, and that every party can understand that, okay, I can own part of that, and I can be in charge of part of that, and I can be safe and secure that nothing will happen with the collateral in case I will follow the consensus rules, which is if the price of collateral is falling down, the consensus rule for borrower, you add more to collateral or you do the partial repayment or you do a repayment. And for a lender, you know, you pay loan and receive loan back and then do the release transaction in favor of the borrower because he has repaid the loan. So that's, I think, and there's like, again, you can build a lot of different things on top of Bitcoin, which actually can improve the current credit markets across the globe, traditional finance market. Like, I'll give you a short example. Take credit cards. Like, the average interest rate in US for a credit card, I think it was last year, it was 28%. 28%, the average interest rate for a credit card.
My God.
Why so? Well, I assume it's because banks give you this credit card loan as to individual because the repayment and your obligations are based on the promise that in the future you will have the same cash flow stream that you had before you have taken this credit card. So you will have a salary, You won't go crazy. You will do a proper repayment, but they need to, they don't have any collateral underlying this credit card interest rate, right? Mm-hmm. They only have your promise, your certain credit history, which is a history. We know that something that happened in the past doesn't necessarily going to happen in the future. And usually that's how it goes. So they have this risk premium and they put a certain risk because they do understand that part of their customers are not going to pay back. So they charge 28% and they charge it for most of the customers, right? So with Bitcoin, if you have this underlying asset for a credit card, then you can actually drop down this risk premium and you can actually ensure that you can provide a better service, lower interest rate, and that you can be secure as a lender because that credit card loan is actually over collateralized and there's an underlying asset. And there's no asset out there for a retail guy, for a simple, you know, average Joe, that he can go to the bank and say, okay, I can collateralize my credit card loan and get better interest other than Bitcoin out there. Because like Bitcoin is for everyone. If you own a fraction of Bitcoin, you can already do that. And actually that's one I already kind of, you know, probably shared some secrets with you, but that's where we're moving with DeFi. And that's only one part of the credit markets, you know, that can be improved with Bitcoin, because it's very easy to build credit products on top of that. It's very easy to use Bitcoin as a collateral. You don't need, like, there's no stocks who are being used as underlying collateral for your credit card. It's nonsense. There's no real estate, probably, right? But Bitcoin can be used for that. And Bitcoin can become a pretty nice collateral for most of the use cases out there.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Buy low, sell high. It's easy to say, hard to do. For example, high interest rates are crushing the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices are falling, even for many of the best assets. It's no wonder the Fundrise Flagship Fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its billion-dollar real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise Flagship Fund to your portfolio in just minutes with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/WSB. That's fundrise.com/WSB. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise Flagship Fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement. As someone who's constantly on the road and traveling, Briggs & Riley has been a game changer that ensures my travel experience is phenomenal. I'm a satisfied customer of Briggs & Riley myself, and I can certainly tell you that their luggage performs. It's extremely durable, it has amazing features that make packing and getting around easier, and they have the best lifetime guarantee in the industry. If your bag is ever broken or damaged, they'll repair it free of charge, no questions asked, even if your airline damages the bag. They also just released their Simpatico collection of hard-sided luggage. It has this new one-touch feature which allows you to expand your luggage, pack it, then compress it to its original size so a carry-on can still fit in the overhead compartment, plus many other cool features. If you want luggage that was awarded the best carry-on by Forbes, then now's the time to get it. Get your new and improved luggage at Briggs-Riley.com. That's Briggs-Riley.com.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4x points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4x points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
All right, back to the show.
How do you think through, so on the credit card piece, my mind immediately jumps to the volatility of the underlying collateral, which is Bitcoin, which is, call it 70% annualized volatility. And so when you're looking at how much that person would be able to borrow against at a much lower rate than the, what was the number you said, 25% annualized for traditional credit cards, somewhere in that
28%, 28% the average rate.
28% annualized. I would imagine that if you had some type of Bitcoin collateral, it drops it to what, 12%, 15%, somewhere in that ballpark? Am I close?
We've been doing our research, talking with lenders. Well, most of them, because again, more greedy. So most of them are saying it's somewhere in the range between 40% to 20%, but still it's like twice lower than this current interest rate.
Yeah. So, but some of that lower rate is also dependent on the collateral having to be pretty substantial, or at least the additional backing that you would have to be able to put in there to not have it called or converted because it dips below that. Is also a part of the calculation, I guess. So if a person has a lot of Bitcoin, they can obviously have a much higher rate without the threat of it being converted because of the such intense volatility of the underlying collateral. So I guess, how would you think about that in an offering to the public or to anybody that would be looking at that and saying, well, of course I want to pay half the rate, but you also have to have a whole lot more collateral to make sure that it doesn't convert.
Well, actually, that's the mindset we need to change. You know, you don't have credit cards with underlying collateral. Your credit card is usually like triple of your salary, right? So you get like one, let's simplify. You get $1,000 salary per month. They will provide you $3,000. So $2,000 is non-existent. Mm-hmm. You can cover $1,000 with your salary. Most probably you won't be able because you also have other expenses. So that's the mindset you need to change, because suddenly for credit card, there's an underlying asset. And usually if we talk about fiat versus Bitcoin in terms of lending, it's 50% LTV ratio. So in order to borrow, let's say 1,000 in fiat, you need to put 2,000 in Bitcoin, which is, again, it's a multisig based. And you don't sell Bitcoin. It's non-taxable event. Mm-hmm. And you get double the interest rate that you actually will pay for a credit card. I think it's a good offering. Mm-hmm. But again, it should be changed, the mindset that suddenly there's a collateral that can be divided in small fractions and it can be easily delivered to basically underlying account that supports your credit card, and that the credit card for average Joe can be actually collateralized as well. It's not only something, some big heavy loans, real estate loan can be collateralized. With Bitcoin, you can collateralize very small loans.
Yeah.
And lenders will be happy to pay because they don't have, they're over-collateralized. It's win-win for them. If you get liquidated, they will get Bitcoin, or they will get fiat if you have a liquidation agent in place. So there's like, it's a win-win. They don't need to. And obviously, the biggest win for them is that they can be sure that 100% of their loans will be repaid, instead of usually the rate is 70% and 30%. So they 70% will repay with 28% of interest, and 30% will most probably will fail. And with that 28, they will cover the rest. So adjusted, it will be around 20%, which is fine for them. Here you will have, across the population of your credit card owners, you will have 100% of repayment. Even if they will fail repay you with fiat, you will always have a collateral that you can get and cover all your expenses and obligations.
Max,
that's the beauty of Bitcoin.
If I'm an executive at a traditional bank and I'm listening to this conversation, I'm thinking to myself, all right, so how in the world can I access Debify via some type of API or something to start incorporating what deep knowledge you have on this particular subject and doing it in a very responsible kind of way? And so I guess my question is that an offering that you guys are trying to work with traditional institutions to provide it via an API, or is it just they have to come directly to Debify and start using the interface that you have there? Is it something that you're
Currently they have to go to Debify and start using the interface. So we'll help them with onboarding. We have a team like a concierge team who are doing the onboarding, helping them. But soon we will release an API so they can actually use our API and they can integrate Debify in their systems. So if you're using an internet bank and suddenly you want to borrow with Bitcoin, you don't necessarily need to leave the internet bank of your bank. Mm-hmm. You can just use it as it is with the interfaces that are familiar to you. So we're already like building the API, so you will be able to connect. And then there again, there's two ways of how lenders can interact with Debify. So we have a hybrid model in that sense. So you can go and become a lender directly on the platform, which is great because you will have direct access to the borrowers that we bring on the platform. You will have direct access. You will get all your interest payment to your pocket, basically. And there's also certain partnerships we have where the funds, like licensed and regulated funds, they can provide you a service of managing the liquidity on Debify. So you can basically do the arrangement with them, wire them money, they will manage that liquidity, and you will earn certain interest from that, and they will charge you a certain fee for that. So we're trying to build a different type of approach to this, to Bitcoin as a collateral, you know. Of course, we prefer if banks will be onboarded directly to Debify and they will actually start managing. And we're actually building the platform in that way that even non-technical person, like from traditional finance work, can be easily onboarded and can use that easily with no hustle in that sense. But we understand that there could be, as we call them, lazy lenders who just have a bunch of liquidity. They don't want to micromanage anything. They are happy to wire funds to a regulated entity, which will do the micromanaging on their behalf.
How do you see the key management for, so let's say I'm a bank, I'm going to tap into this API that it seems like you guys are going to be rolling out pretty soon. How would the key management look like for a customer of that bank that's basically using Debify, but the wrapper is the bank for the customer standpoint? How would the customer be using those keys from that bank?
We have several approaches, but two most common approaches that we're offering. So first of all, we have, as Debify, we have an app. So Debify is an ecosystem which contains two parts, equal parts, app, which is a Debify app, and a website. So Debify app, I'm going to show it to you. There's like, I don't know where, probably it's blurring, but there's like a bunch of keys. Yeah, there it is. So the app is actually your key storage. So the only purpose of app at the moment is to hold your key on your mobile device. So every time you need to create escrow or you need to release funds, our website will send you a signal here to the app to press a button to, you know, to enter 2FA, password, all these PIN codes, whatever. And you will do it then release. So we separated the utility, which is website, from the actual security, which is your app. So your mobile phone effectively becoming a key storage device.
Yeah.
Not similar to the hardware wallet, but it's way more better if we also remember that there's like four keys distributed across several parties. And of course, we're going to add pretty much soon hardware wallet support. So you will be able to hold your keys on a hardware wallet, working together with the app. So the keys will be distributed. And of course, through API, you can also do a different type of key management. You can even store it like online on your server, which we don't encourage, but that's a possibility. If, for example, other involved parties will say, okay, we're storing our keys in cold storage, and we can allow you to store your keys in a hot storage, which is not very secured, but again, it's a multisig. You know, there's multiple keys. Even if your key somehow get hijacked or compromised, then you need to get two more keys in order to do something with the collateral. So there's different options. We're still like working, developing them, but at the moment it's just an app that holds the key. For institutional lenders, we have a bit different approach. Usually we have a technical, the cold storage are coming because it's highly requested feature, but again, it's from the borrower side. You know, they want to store their keys on the hardware device they know, like cold card, for example, or Trezor or Ledger. So this is that's the next step. It's going to be available pretty much soon.
The last question I have for you, Max, is just, I think anybody listening to this will quickly realize that so much of the future of this is really dependent on stable coins and the liquidity of stable coins. And depending on where you live in the world, there's different policies that are emerging. I'm just kind of curious your general thoughts on the direction of stablecoin issuers, whether you think that this is something that from a policies standpoint globally is trending in a direction that's becoming more open or more closed, or just your general thoughts on it all around.
Like on HODL, if we compare to, again, on HODL, you can only borrow with stablecoins. So on DeFi, currently you can borrow with stablecoins, but in 1 month from now, as we speak, there will be also fiat loans available. We actually already help to basically deliver some fiat loans to that extent. So we are trying to, we understand that the most liquidity still is in fiat. And the traditional financial institutions, they work mostly with fiat. They still don't understand what is a stablecoin. For stablecoin, I think the general approach is the same as with Bitcoin. There are markets and regions that are very aggressive towards regulating, you know, enforcing, even prohibiting even Bitcoin, you know, not only stablecoin, but even Bitcoin. And there are markets who are happy to, you know, to get this adoption up and running. Like in Latin America, for example, if you compare their countries like Salvador, El Salvador, which is basically Bitcoin is a legal tender there. Mm-hmm. And there's also countries like Argentina. If you go to Argentina, everyone is using Tether. You know, everyone is using USDT. People are happy to borrow against Bitcoin with USDT. They don't care. They don't do conversion to the fiat because USDT is widely used in Argentina and in multiple countries in Latin America, actually. You know, and the stable coins are widely used for cross-border payments in Asia, in Eastern Europe, a lot of countries, actually. And I think that the general, I would say it's becoming more and more obvious that it's an elephant in the room that you cannot ignore anymore. And I think that I see that most of the stablecoin issuers, they're happy to, you know, to work together with government authorities to help them understand to, because I don't think anything bad, I don't find anything bad in that sense, because for me, stablecoin is way more better version of fiat. If we choose between fiat and stablecoin, again, we don't take Bitcoin in that equation. But if we choose between fiat and stablecoin, then actually stablecoin allows you to be more peer-to-peer than fiat. You know, with stablecoin, I can just send you, let's take Liquid, for example. There's Tether on top of Liquid. I can send you Tether directly, you know, with no middleman. You will receive that in like 5 minutes or even less. I will pay 10 cents for sending you, let's say, a million worth of Tether. It will be confidential. And there's nothing wrong about. We are like, it's an evolution of money. There was like traditional finance. There was money. There was gold. Then there was banknotes. Then we know what happened in 1971, I think. Now it's, then there was Bitcoin. Now it's stable coins. And we're just moving. It's an evolution. It's a normal process. You know, we are moving forward. We are improving. And I think in general, like, again, I might answer your question or might not as a politician, but I think that the case with stablecoin is similar to the case with Bitcoin. I think that there will always be countries that is going to be wrong on the history path. Those who encourage the innovation, they will prevail and win eventually. Those who will try to ban something, they will lose because, as I say, life will always find a path to grow somewhere. And I think that financial freedom is something that you cannot ignore anymore in 21st century, and you need to embrace it. As a government, you need to embrace that.
Well, I just want to tell you, as a person who's been your friend through the years and seen you navigate something as complex as a borrowing and lending platform through a period of just intense volatility and disruption where all these people with just unbound amounts of counterparty risk blow up and then the next one blows up and the next one blows up. And here you guys are just continuing to plug away, offering a service to people that are borrowing and lending without any interruption. There's no greater compliment than just your performance that I can really kind of talk to for people to kind of really understand why I trust a person like yourself to cover this really what's the word I'm looking for? This is a very energized topic for a lot of people in the space. And I really appreciate you and what you've done to kind of lead by example. And it's really exciting for me to know that you're offering a product to institutions for them to see how this can be done in a thoughtful, in a way that is de-risked as much as possible and in a responsible manner, because I'm very concerned that a lot of them are going to show up playing fractional reserve fiat games at a time when this thing, this thing's going to be relentless if you bring that mindset and that approach to it. So just really appreciate it.
Thank you. We just covered basically, I think we covered just 5% of, you know, lending and everything, yes. but we'll continue. Eventually we know we will continue, but I think that eventually they will play the old school playbook. And there will be like some people will get burned, of course, because Bitcoin is a different, you know, they think that it's the same asset as it was, you know, previous one, but it's a different, you know. But if at least 5% of them will try to understand and use different approach, I mean, like non-custodial approach, respecting your borrower and respecting your customer and your customer right to having their own asset and an independent asset, then I think those 5% again will prevail and eventually they will grow stronger and bigger. Because like bull bear market, they happen. We see that, you know, some get busted and some get stronger. And I think that we're there, we can provide them with tools. It's up to them to decide whether they want to use that tool or not. Because we know that some of them will use, and those who will use will be on the forefront of the adoption and on the forefront of actual making money in an ethical way. So yeah, that's my final thought.
Love it. Love it. Max, thank you so much for making time and coming on. We'll have links to HODL HODL. We'll have links to Debify in there if people want to read up and learn more. And just thank you for your time and coming on the show.
Thank you very much, Preston. It was a pleasure. Talk soon with you.
If you guys enjoyed this conversation, be sure to follow the show on whatever podcast application you use. Just search for We Study Billionaires. The Bitcoin specific shows come out every Wednesday, and I'd love to have you as a regular listener. If you enjoyed the show or you learned something new or you found it valuable, if you can leave a review, we would really appreciate that. And it's something that helps others find the interview in the search algorithm. So anything you can do to help out with a review, we would just greatly appreciate. And with that, thanks for listening, and I'll catch you again next week.
Thank you for listening to TIP. Make sure to follow Bitcoin Fundamentals on your favorite podcast app and never miss out on episodes. To access our show notes, transcripts, or courses, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decision, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the Investors Podcast Network. Written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.